Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Leidy Klotz. He's a professor in the Engineering, Architecture, and Business Schools at the University of Virginia. And we're going to talk about the ideas and the lessons in his book, Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less, which has just been released in paperback. And you can learn more at leidyklotz.com. And yes, I will spell that for you. L-E-I-D-Y, Leidy, Klotz, K-L-O-T-Z.com. So leidyklotz1word.com. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 4 p.m. Pacific. Streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net. Today's guest has noticed, as have many others, that we're much more likely to pile on to-dos than we are to consider stop-doings. We're more likely to collect new and improved ideas than to prune outdated ones. Our homes are full of stuff and our minds are full of information. Our economies are built on never-ending growth, our planet chokes on pollution, and our climate turns on us as greenhouse gases multiply. More. Well, Leidy Klotz reminds us that across challenges, big and small, we neglect a basic way to make things better. We don't subtract. But he does more than rail or blame. He examines why. What is it in our biology, our psychology, our culture that leads us all too often to ignore even the possibility of subtraction? Once he's made a good case for how widespread and pernicious this blind spot can be, he offers cases where we've overcome it, guidance on how to cultivate it, and a vision for how our lives and our planet can thrive when we learn to both add and subtract. I like the sound of this on a personal level and on a cultural, even global one, in terms of getting us off the growth train. In order to grow our quality of life more than our appetite for consumption, on an individual level, we need more time to think and to feel. And on a national or global level, we need to reduce our dependence on material growth for satisfaction and meaning. Could the cultivation of subtraction reveal a path to both a better quality of life and an effective response to the climate crisis? Big questions. Leidy Klotz is a professor at the University of Virginia, where he directs the university's Convergent Behavioral Science Initiative and is appointed in the schools of engineering, architecture, and business. His research on the science of problem solving has appeared in both Nature and Science, and his book, just released in paperback, Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less. Welcome, Leidy Klotz, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks for having me, Terrence. It's great to be here. And that was a beautiful intro you just did.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, April 5th. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you find yourself doing today? And feel free to go way back, mention mentors, turning points, detours, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Okay, I'll do the intro I do when I'm talking to students in my class and
sure,
helping them understand who I am. But I lived for soccer growing up, so as soon as I could kick a ball, that was my main passion, and that really guided all of my decision-making all the way through college. So it affected where I went to college, what I focused on in college, which was soccer, not necessarily academics. I got good enough grades for my parents to keep supporting my work in college, and I knew that I was going to eventually not be able to play soccer anymore. I did manage to play professional soccer for a couple seasons after college. I was making $2,000 a month, so it wasn't like I was Lionel Messi, but it was a good post-college job. And
where did you do it? Did you do it overseas or the MSL? What did you do?
I did it in, it's one league below the Major League Soccer. So I played for the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, and we played some of the MLS teams. We actually did pretty well against them, about a 500 record, and traveled around the United States. And yeah, it was great. But I eventually realized this wasn't going to be a career. One memorable moment, I was in the supermarket and I was deciding whether I could buy cheese that week. And that was whether I could afford cheese for my egg and cheese sandwiches. And I was like, you know, this is fine for just me, but when it comes to having a family and some of these other things that I want to accomplish, that's not going to work financially. And I also thought, kind of getting back to the topic of your show, like, how do I contribute to a better world? And certainly, not to say soccer players don't. I think they provide a lot of entertainment value and escape. But, you know, I thought I had skills that I could use to contribute to a better world. So this goes back to when I'm talking to my students. The point here is that don't stress out so much about what your college major is, because I wasn't even thinking about my career until 2 years after college. But I had majored in civil engineering, and so I got my first job building schools in New Jersey, and I liked it, but it wasn't incredibly meaningful. I had grown up really caring about the environment. My dad's a retired biology professor, and my mom went to college in Vermont in the 70s. So there was a strong environmental ethic growing up, and we kind of understood this interdependence of humans and nature. And so that was always an issue that I cared about, that as I started thinking about how do I want to use my career to make the world a better place, it went in that direction. And I realized that there's so much to be done with the physical things that we make. So, you know, buildings use 40% of the energy in the United States, I think, and maybe globally it's even more. So in terms of trying to address climate change, for example, there are huge opportunities in the area that I was already kind of gaining some knowledge in. So at that point, I started merging these ideas. I'll fast forward a little bit here. And one of the things that you keep noticing when you're studying these areas is that a lot of times the technologies are there, right? We know how to build net zero energy buildings. That's a feasible thing. That's not physically impossible. A lot of the barriers are mental ones, whether designers thinking of it or, you know, implementing it and making it a social norm, aligning the financial incentives so that the, you know, people are more willing to invest upfront to get some payback later. And so I got more and more interested in the reasons, these non-engineering reasons why a more sustainable built environment doesn't come about. A fundamental question when we're designing things, arguably the most fundamental, is when we take something and try to change it from how it is to how we want it to be, right? This is whether we're building a building or whether we're trying to create a world that just might work. That's a question that we're asking ourselves, right? And why is it that our first instinct is to think, hey, what can we add? And then what are the consequences of that, right? If we, is it just that we think of adding first and then think of subtracting, or is it that we think of adding first and then sometimes overlook subtraction entirely? The book is a result of discovering that, hey, sometimes we systematically overlook subtraction. That is, we think of adding, we move on, we don't even consider this basic way to make change. And then that insight, the scientific insight, the book is a way of kind of unpacking that and putting it into the hands of people who can make change in the world with it, describing why this is, for example, and what to do about it.
Very good. Let me ask you a question about your path. I'm struck by that you have appointments in three different schools, and I heartily approve. I will just share this. I'm a graduate of Harvard from the late 60s, kind of contemporary with what your mother was dealing with in Vermont. The school recently brought in a vice provost to deal with how they're going to deal with climate, not necessarily from the physical plant standpoint, but in the curriculum and all of that. And so they had us all take a survey. What would you do different? One of my primary things was that problems like climate, problems like inequality, problems like our endangered democracy, three of the critical crises I see us facing, are not going to be solved by thinking of things in discrete departments. I think it's Buckminster Fuller who said nature has no departments. My biggest advocacy was to focus on the problem and then approach it interdisciplinarily. You've managed to do that in your career. How'd you do it?
I've had supportive colleagues and bosses that have allowed me to focus on the problem. So I want to acknowledge that. And I realize that not all people are as fortunate to have that. I also just didn't care. I mean, the reason that I'm doing this career is to make change in the world. And if, you know, I'll do the work that I think needs to be done, with, you know, obviously keeping in mind the skills that I have and the resources that I have, and then figure out how to make it add up for the bean counters later. So I think a little bit of a, you know, very fortunate to be in some supportive environments, but also very motivated by solving the real world problems, which I guess, as Fuller said, don't stick in individual departments.
Right, right. And so you have written another book on soccer.
Yeah.
But this is the first book that sort of is about your work. How did this book happen? Was there a moment you said, this is the book I got to write? What was the first itch you scratched? That sort of question.
The soccer book is about kind of sustainability and systems thinking. So in a lot of ways, the soccer book talks a lot about what we just discussed. But yeah, this book, Subtract, I would say if there was a moment where it was like, oh, geez, this is a big idea that is worth the time to write a book, and that is worth not just my time, but people's time to read a book, right? Because I'm asking people to spend 7 hours of their life with this thing. It's probably when I was playing Legos with my son, who was three at the time, and we were basically building a bridge when it wasn't level. So if you can imagine an unlevel bridge, it's got one column that was longer than the other. And I turned around to add a block to the shorter column, and I had turned back around, and my son had already removed a block from the longer column. So what happened in that moment was I had always been interested in, why are we privileging growth? What about minimalism? What about these kind of elegant designs and all these analogous concepts, but never had really honed in on this fundamental act of subtracting, right? So less is an end state, but subtracting is how we get there. And so that Lego bridge really kicked off the scientific investigation, which then, based on the science that we were finding, kind of led into the book.
You write a lot, and I want us to talk a bit about the research you began to do once this question loomed there. And it's an interesting, I think, moment when me, the layperson, can look behind and go, well, what is it they're doing? You know, how do they arrive at something that's not just a hunch, but actually they've feel they can say is a conclusion or that sort of thing. And I think you do a very good job of it. What surprised you most in working on this book?
I think the most surprising scientific insight was finding out that we don't even think of subtraction. I think there's all this evidence out there that suggests, okay, there are reasons why we would think of subtraction and then not choose it. But what our experiments and the new addition we made to the science was that, look, there are many cases when we don't even think about this basic option. And we'll skip over all the detailed scientific experiments for now. And what we found was very similar to what happened to me in that moment with the bridge, which was I turned back around with this block ready to add it. And if my son hadn't shown me the subtractive option, I would have added and moved on without even considering subtraction, without even considering this other option. And it's pretty trivial. You could argue that the bridge with fewer blocks is better because it conserves resources, but both created a level bridge. In some of our experiments, we made it objectively worse to add. And so there was an experiment, for example, where you had to protect a stormtrooper from a falling block. And the way to do it was to add between 4 and 8 Lego blocks or to subtract 1 Lego block. And so if people realized or thought of the subtractive option, they would do it. And then we had We tested this in a lot of different ways. I think the most convincing were random grids on a computer screen, and we would give people patterns, basically four quadrants of grid patterns, and there'd be extraneous marks in one of the quadrants. And when people, so the way to solve the patterns, to make them symmetrical, was to either add blocks to three quadrants or to subtract blocks from one quadrant. And again, subtracting objectively correct, but people would add and then move on without even considering the objectively correct option. And so I think it's definitely the most surprising thing that I learned in writing the book. Honestly, I don't think I would have written the book without that insight, because that's chapter one. And then the rest of the book is kind of going through, knowing this, how can we reevaluate what we know about subtracting from a biological evolution standpoint, from a cultural evolution standpoint, from a economic standpoint, and GDP and growth and all these things, and then go into, okay, how can we get better at it, knowing that it's not just a matter of not choosing subtraction, we also have to think of it in the first place and then choose it, and there are barriers to doing that too.
Okay, let's go into that research just a little bit. What I liked was the way that you unfolded, okay, so we got this insight. Now let's test certain things. And there's a very nice progression in that. Okay, this test seems to indicate this, so we can eliminate that possibility. This seems to verify that, yeah. This seems to confirm that. Take us through that for about the next 3, 4, or 5 minutes.
Awesome. Thanks for the opportunity. I think it's really important to share, and I think people will learn a lot of how to overcome this bias from understanding it in this detail. The basic question we're grappling with is, okay, are people not subtracting because they're choosing not to, which wouldn't be a problem, or are people not even considering subtraction in the first place? It's hard to show that in any given single experiment. So we give people these travel itineraries, and it was a ridiculous trip to Washington, D.C., where they would visit 14 different places, like big places, the Smithsonian Museum and the Lincoln Memorial, and have like this four-star dinner, and they could drag and drop and they would add. But you could always argue, or one could argue that, well, they just like a busy itinerary, right? So you've got to figure out ways to show that, okay, they're doing this even though it goes against what they actually would want to do if they realized it. Knowing the cognitive science, we could explore this in few different ways. And here seems like a good time to mention the essential role of collaboration, right? Because you mentioned my background in engineering, architecture, and business. And I think, you know, most of my contributions are in behavioral science, but I'm certainly not a professor of psychology and not at that level. And so I was able to collaborate with some who are friends, Gabe Adams, Ben Converse, and Andy Hales. And so together we started to unpack this. Okay, well, if people weren't thinking of it, what would make them think of it? And so one of the things that seems obvious in retrospect is reminders, right? So if you remind people that, hey, did you think of subtracting? And so what we would do is we give people the grids, for example, and say, hey, remember, you can add or subtract, and this increased rates of subtracting, which, you know, big deal, right? Reminders should increase rates of things, but they didn't increase the rates of adding. So what this shows is people are already thinking of adding, right? For the reminder was redundant for adding, but for subtracting, it brought ideas to mind that wouldn't have otherwise come to mind. That's some evidence that, hey, people weren't thinking of this. Another thing we did was repetition. We'd have people solve the grid patterns multiple times. And if on the fourth or fifth time they stumbled across subtraction, and then we'd ask them which was the best solution. So they'd stumble upon it randomly and then realize, hey, this is actually better, and then they would choose it, right? And this is what happened to my son. Some people will take the story and say, oh, little kids are good subtractors, and my son is not a good subtractor. He just was playing a lot of Legos, and this was the moment when he came across subtraction.
What you're saying there is that by doing it multiple times and looking for new options, eventually this one comes up. If it tends to come up only the fourth or fifth time, we don't normally run ourselves through 4 or 5 times.
Exactly. And what's the practical takeaway there, right? It's like, oh, now we should just solve problems 5 times. I mean, that's a very blunt a blunt takeaway, right? We don't have time to do that. And then the other one, kind of the kicker, was the cognitive load study that we did. The idea being that we know that our brain faces competing demands, right? And when it's stressed in some ways, when it's trying to attend to other information, it pays less attention to the kind of problem-solving task. And so to the extent that, okay, is this tendency to add, is that our default wiring, is that our first instinct? If so, then when we're taxed, when we're under cognitive load, when our mental bandwidth is taken up by something else, then we should be even more likely to add, right? Because we rely even more on our default wiring in those moments. We're basically thinking less. And so the way that you can do that on research studies is one classic way is to give people a scroll of numbers across the bottom of the screen as they're solving the task. So people would be working on that grid task that I just explained while also looking at this scroll of numbers and pressing an F key every time a 5 went by. So it's the equivalent of texting and driving, right? You're trying to do two things at once. And when people were doing that second task, at their rates of adding increased, suggesting that they relied more on their mental default, which was to think of adding first and then move on. So those, you know, the repetitions, the reminders, and then the cognitive load combined together, and the evidence from those studies suggest that this is something that we're not even thinking of.
Right. And that thing that you mentioned earlier about where you were finally just making choices and decisions about a grid on a screen, that's to neutralize any preconceived or pre-held values about Legos or about Washington.
Exactly.
Or about anything else. You made it about as neutral a thing as it could possibly be. And if it comes through there, we can assume it's fairly hardwired.
Exactly.
Very, very good. Okay, and as I said, the way that this works is once he's established some questions around the notion of subtraction and our disinclination to use it, then there's this couple of chapters that really go, we tested this and that, well, that left this question open, and then we tested that, and that seemed to take care of that one, but it still left, could it be this, could it be that? And I just think for people who either love psychological studies or doubt psychological research, to see how this is done, I thought was interesting and helpful. So once you've done this, you've kind of established that this insight you had has now seems to be fairly well rooted and kind of, as we say, default. What happens then?
As you know, and your listeners know, I mean, there are multiple reasons for any behavior, right? There's the cognition, but there are evolutionary reasons, there are cultural reasons, there are economic and social structures. And so basically, it's like, hey, we've got this new insight, now let's look at this through the lens of these different factors that influence behavior. Evolutionary factors might be, okay, what about adding has been helpful in having us and other species pass down their genes, right? And so you could think about something obvious like stockpiling food in good times is a behavior that helps you survive through lean times. So you can see how that kind of acquisitiveness or that additive behavior could be explained from an evolutionary perspective. More surprising on the evolutionary side, and this is where you start to see why investigating the science can also be helpful in our practical lives, is this notion of competence. And so competence is showing that we can affect change in the world. The example I use in the book are bowerbirds. The males will build ceremonial nests for the females. Then the females go around, look at the nests, and decide which male to mate with based on how much they like the ceremonial nest. And then the female goes and builds a nest to shelter the young. And so the whole point of that first nest, there's no shelter function. It's just to show that the bird that built it is effective at interacting with the world, which, you know, is proof that this is going to be a gene that is also good for getting food or other things. This idea of displaying competence by building things is in all of us, but also the very famous psychologist Albert Bandura extended this notion of competence from physical things to task completion. And so we also can scratch this competence itch by doing another to-do or attending a meeting. I think of this in my own work life. It's like if I go to this faculty meeting that I have tomorrow morning, one outcome will be that my colleagues will see that Leidy's participating, right? And Leidy's contributing something. If I skip the faculty meeting and do something else, I won't be able to display evidence of my competence. So say, for example, I sat and read articles. It's still doing something useful, but it's not displaying evidence of my competence through task completion. And so I think this is something, it's a biological force that we're battling when we struggle with busyness, for example, and when we struggle with overloaded physical spaces or having too much stuff in our homes. Mm-hmm. So that's a biological example. I love getting into the cultural evolution examples too, or reasons for this from a cultural evolution standpoint. So just as biology evolves, our culture evolves, and our culture evolves much faster because one of the ways it evolves is through ideas, which, you know, it doesn't take a full adaptation and selection, a new
right,
idea.
Right. When we talk about biological causes or biological inclinations, most of our time on this planet, the thing was, yeah, how do we find enough food to survive? How do we find a safe enough place to sleep? And how do we procreate? And that was basically it. So the cultural evolution of the last several centuries is meaningful, but when we talk about biological evolution, it doesn't matter that much what happened last week or 10 years ago. It's in us from a lot longer ago than that. And let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Leidy Klotz. He's a professor in the Engineering, Architecture, and Business Schools at the University of Virginia. And we're talking about the ideas and the helpful lessons in his book, Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less. You can learn more at LeidyKlotz.com. That's LeidyKlotz.com. Let's talk then about culture.
Perfect. Yeah. So biology, we have this long history, and then cultural evolution kind of kicked in about 10,000 years ago, more or less. And the question is, what about our kind of going from bands of hunter-gatherers to the civilizations that we live in now? How might adding have shown itself during that time? And of course, so much of the development of civilization has been additive, right? I mean, when we didn't have roads, when we didn't have cities, the better option, I would argue, was to add them. And so, you know, I've got an example in the book of removing a double-decker freeway in San Francisco to reveal the Embarcadero. Well, when people were starting civilization, that subtractive option was not available to them. And it's the same if you think about this in terms of our schedules or our bureaucracies, right? It's like when you don't have any kind of organizations, there's nothing to prune, there's to make them more streamlined. So one point when you look at this from a cultural evolution standpoint is that for a long time, it's made more sense to add. Another thing that was really surprising to me, and I love big objects. I'm a civil engineer by training. That's why I went into it. I like these large structures. But I was still surprised to learn how fundamental, like the anthropologists and archaeologists and the people who study this kind of history of civilization think that the building of these large objects was to our civilizations coming about. There's this example in Turkey called Potbelly Hill, where the bands of hunter-gatherers came together and basically created this circle of stones that are as big as giraffes, each of the stones. And so what it showed is that people had to work together to move those stones around. People had to figure out how they were going to stay in this one spot to build this big project. They couldn't roam around. They would have to stay to work on the project. This building of big physical was there at the genesis of most civilizations. And the theory is that, okay, building the body of civilization is also what, you know, kind of brought people together. So the work required to build these big objects was what made people come together to have organized religion, to have agriculture. And that's become kind of the prevailing view, if my research is accurate, my research into the research that's out there is accurate. And so what that says is that at the beginning of civilization, all of us kind of share this love for building large things, and we're all we all have kind of, all of our civilizations have come from civilizations like that.
So in other words, the bands of hunter-gatherers that still remain in the Amazon or, you know, a few other places, they have not built those large structures. Once we find the large structures, then we begin to find a more stationary way to live, and that demands a lot of other cultural adaptations. And
yeah, and I mean, again, this is there is no single reason, but if we're looking at these forces, you know, if you think of them as biological forces and cultural forces, it's like all of the cultural forces in the history of the dominant civilizations today are, you know, kind of have evolved from this adding right from the beginning. So civilization has been a very additive pursuit.
Okay. Now you have
mostly for good.
Yeah. So you have, that's right. In other words, in terms of progress, more people survive, you're stationary. Now you evolve cultures, art grows. There's all sorts of wonderful things. And as you mentioned in your book, and as I think people understand, is that a lot of what looks like, problems or crises now in terms of too much information, too much stuff, too much greenhouse gases, too much plastics in the ocean, that is all really fairly recent. And by fairly recent, it might be two centuries or so. And I think that's what was good for so long started creating problems when we got too good at it. Let's shift now to, we've established that we don't, that our default is to add. It's the way our mind seems to work. It's the way our decision making seems to work. It's the way our cultures seem to work. What, once you're there, now you've got to begin saying, well, what do we do with this insight? Because I think one of the key insights you say is if, and this is what you established with some of those early psychological experiments, if we're not even thinking to subtract, we're not even going to that step, then there must be potential positive in doing so. And it's sort of, so, okay, so how do we begin on an individual and a cult and a societal basis to begin to cultivate and take advantage of what we have been ignoring or minimizing? Fair enough?
Fair, perfect, and beautiful. I think it's such an important point. I'm not anti-adding. And in fact, if I had to choose one or the other, I'd probably just choose adding, but we don't have to choose. And these are complementary ways to make change. But the real potential is, like you said, it's not just that, okay, here's another way to change. It's also, here's another way to change that we've been overlooking for a long time systematically, which should mean that there's latent potential there.
Okay. And so point well made. It is not either or. It is both and, both add and subtract. And as someone who's done improvisational theater, yes, okay, and is the key coaching in any improvisational theater. And I would suggest in life, yes, and. And one of the things that, of course, we can see in the polarization in our society is this false urge to go either or, when in fact yes and is where the growth is. You make the point that you think what most people really want is infinite progress, not infinite growth, and I think that applies both in our personal lives and societally. How do we begin to move that way on an individual level first?
Yeah. So you're listening to this as a start. Seriously, right? I mean, so like the awareness, I mean, one way to think of something more is to be reminded, right? Just as those, we had very simple reminders in our study, and that was enough people to consider and then choose it back then. So I think this is serving as a reminder. My book hopefully serves as a reminder and maybe even kind of rearranges your mental furniture a little bit. But I also think it's really important when you're thinking about it, like right now, or right after you listen to this, to think about where you can put these reminders in place so that they're there when you're doing the task. So say, for example, my to-do list that I do try to do on a weekly basis. It's like, can I force myself in the process of doing my to-do list? Okay, Lighty, now you have to come up with an equal amount of stop doings, which makes sense, right? Because if you're going to take on four new things, you should probably figure out what four things you're going to stop doing. But that's a step that at least I had been skipping before. But by forcing that reminder into my regular process, it makes me less likely to systematically overlook subtraction. So I think those reminders are incredibly helpful, but not just, okay, here's a passive reminder, but also, can you build reminders into the important decision-making points in your own life?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump back to one other thing, which is, I think I didn't bring you into a couple of more examples of good subtraction. So the one that you mentioned was the Embarcadero. It was a freeway that existed, and as long as it existed, people just took it for granted, even if some people thought that it would be better not there. But it was only because of the earthquake that damaged that freeway that allowed it to actually be subtracted. You can tell that. And then divestment and pocket parks really quickly.
Okay. Yeah, the Embarcadero is a great example. I mean, it's a piece of civil infrastructure that existed in San Francisco, this double-decker highway blocking the freeway. And it existed basically since the Eisenhower administration until 1990 or so. And people always questioned, hey, do we really need a freeway here? Would it be better? Would our city be better off with, you know, a clear view of the bay? And then planners studied it and realized that, look, this was doing more harm than good. But they put it to a vote in the city of San Francisco, and it was basically 2-1 against removing this this eyesore that was blocking the best part of the city. And the reason was, you know, people were worried about change, and in this case, probably traffic, and you know how that would affect the rest of the city, and also how people would get to the businesses that were served by the freeway. And so the planners just shelved it and didn't bring it up again, probably never would have if not for the earthquake that happened. This is the earthquake that happened during the World Series and was the most costly earthquake at that time in the United States history, killed 63 people. A lot of those deaths happened in the collapse of a double-decker highway in Oakland, right? Mm-hmm. So this made clear the dangers of having a double-decker highway in an earthquake zone, and it also damaged the Embarcadero part of the highway enough that it had to shut down for a while so people could see how the city operated when the freeway wasn't serving traffic. And still, it was really close. I mean, the Planning Commission didn't have to put it to a public vote, but the Planning Commission only voted 6-5 to remove the freeway. And then after they removed it, the mayor and Planning Commission were swept out of office. It was still an unpopular decision. And of course, now if you go there, you know, there's no question that it was the right decision. And so what's neat about that example is, okay, even after you think of this, right, because the planners thought of it, and even after you collect evidence, there's still these other forces that prevent us from subtracting. And in this case, you know, like you mentioned, the status quo, it's hard to change from the status quo. And also, and this is in most times a good assumption, is that when something exists, we often assume that there's a good reason for it, mm-hmm. right? We think, hey, somebody thought about this double-decker freeway and knows more than I do about how cities work, and so who am I to question it? And I think that's a good kind of mental shortcut to have, but it also works against subtraction. So that's the Embarcadero freeway example. But it also shows how powerful the subtractions can be. And also, you know, I think one thing that I try to do in the book and in all my teaching is show that this isn't, you think, oh, this is the domain of engineers or city planners. And sure, they have some influence there, but it's really the people who are making these changes. And so Sue Bierman was a neighborhood activist who was really instrumental in having that freeway removed. And she had no formal engineering training. And so I think it also shows that even these really big subtractions can be brought about by individuals working from different working through different channels of power.
Okay, the divestment campaign against South Africa. And now,
yeah, I thought that's where you might go with Harvard, if they're asking what's the most important thing you can do with climate change. And one of the things that, you know, students are now catching on to is, divesting from fossil fuels. And so divesting from fossil fuels as it relates to climate change means, okay, we care about climate change as an institution. I'll use the University of Virginia as an example. We're putting up solar panels, we're doing research in clean energy, and our endowment is also invested in fossil fuel companies. And so you're basically kind of propping up the same system that you're fighting against, and then divesting works by subtracting that investment, and obviously you can reinvest it in something else, so it's not as if you're losing the money. And when you subtract that investment, it eases tension in the system. And divestment was incredibly effective in helping bring down apartheid in South Africa. And for a long time, people recognized that apartheid was wrong, of course, and there were, you know, people speaking out against it. Musicians demonstrating against it, talking official UN sanctions, things like that. And then, you know, the real kind of nail in the coffin of apartheid came when there started this international divestment campaign, which was like, we are not going to invest anymore in companies that have business operations in South Africa. And so the University of California system pulled its endowment funds out of South Africa, and the state of California followed, and this spread around, and all of a sudden there's a huge amount of money going out of South Africa. And, you know, this is money that was kind of propping up this apartheid system. And now you're not fighting against this very strong system anymore. You're just trying to bring down a system that has fewer resources.
Right. Harvard has chosen to divest. They were behind a lot of universities,
yeah.
but they have come around. The other thing I would say is that I suppose, to a great extent, the sanctions that are being imposed now on Russia are another big example of subtraction. In other words, one could say we go in and add a no-fly zone, and we go in and bring in our weapons and so on. We've been unwilling to do that for, I think, very rational reasons. But the sanctions are a subtraction, which we assume and we are hoping causes enough pain that it will influence the decision making in the Kremlin.
Yeah, certainly.
Yep.
And I think, you know, divestment is about the grandest example you can have, right? Because you're talking about pulling money out of the entire system, but you can talk about this with individual policies, with other kind of financial mechanisms. So I think it's, you know, as we're trying to change a system, in this case, apartheid, or you know, a system that's contributing to climate change, are there things that we can remove from that system that will move us towards the same goals? And oftentimes, you know, subtracting is about as good as adding in most cases. But the argument in systems is that all else being equal, subtraction is actually a more powerful way to change the system, because you're relieving tension. You're not just kind of adding another force into the system. You're actually fundamentally relieving tension in the system.
So this is using, to some extent, a physical analogy to what is a more qualitative arena, right? But it works. I'm going to jump in and quote a couple of things just because we're getting tight and I want to make sure I get back to you for the last word. One is, I mentioned pocket parks. If people know, that's where they're in the middle of a city block where there used to be a building, perhaps a derelict building. Instead of replacing it with another building, you leave it open and the green space of one lot will actually change the feel of a block or a neighborhood. And it's a clear action of subtraction that's somewhat defined by all of what's around it. It's that oasis kind of experience that you create because of that subtraction. You talk about Dana Meadows, who was one of the lead writers of Limits to Growth, mm-hmm. back in the early 70s. And Limits to Growth obviously is talking about subtraction. But I find that my lesson from her more than limits was a systems view. And,
exactly.
And you also point out that that's a crucial piece of all this. And I'm going to throw it to you to talk just a little bit about that after I mention one other person that you talk about, which is Ray Anderson, who had a conversion experience. He was a leader of Interface Flooring, perhaps, I think, at the time, the largest flooring carpeting company in America. And he realized a few things when he read The Ecology of Commerce by Paul Hawken. And what he did was he really, it seems, I thought about it more than what was in your book, and really thought he really took subtraction to heart. Though his company sold carpets, he began to envision them not as selling rolled up bunches of fabric, but as selling the services carpet supply, which is comfort, warmth, safety, perhaps. And when you begin to think about how you deliver the services people want more than the products, I think that is an opening for subtraction. And from it came the notion of carpet tiles. Carpet tiles we now take for granted, I think, especially in industrial and office situations. But up until carpet tiles, if you stained the carpet or wore the carpet, you had to replace the whole carpet, even the part that sat under the conference table and never showed any wear and tear. When you go to carpet tiles, you replace just the part that's damaged. That's another great deal of subtraction. And then in terms of running his whole company, he realized that anything that was probably waste going in as well as waste coming out. And so you begin to cut, you look for places in your process to reduce the amount of inputs you're putting in. And then you do what's good for the environment, but it also saves you money because you're not creating as much waste. Let's talk, I'm going to throw it back to you. I just wanted to hit those quickly. Let's throw it back to you for what we do in our individual lives. The first thing you said was a stop doing for every to-do.
Yeah, and even more than that, putting in place these reminders for yourself, you know, so the stop doing for every to-do could be your personal list, but it could also be the physical things that you bring into your house. Mm-hmm. So putting in place these reminders and even rules. And so this rules that, okay, I am going to subtract this much. And so one of my favorite examples I've heard there is, I guess, the British Columbia had a rule where if a legislator wanted to bring a new policy, they had to also come with two that were on the books that that should be gotten rid of. And this is a way to kind of keep our books and balance the books of legislation. And I think that's an example of a rule that it makes it so you can't overlook subtraction as an option. It also kind of prevents this endless march of adding.
And then what about on a societal level? Because it does seem to me that if we began to utilize subtraction more often and it became more of sort of what our mind throws out to us on an individual level, on a company level, on a family level, that the potential for doing it on an economic society-wide and planet-wide level grows. Your thoughts about the relationship of this blind spot to climate change?
Yeah, and this is why I wrote the book. I mean, this is the issue that I care most about, and I think that you've done such a good job leading up to this. That we're in the Anthropocene now, right? This is a fancy way of saying that our epoch is defined by the fact that one species, us, is the dominant influence on the planet. So climate change is the most obvious evidence of that, but there are all these other kind of planetary boundaries that we're pushing up against. And, you know, that seems pessimistic, or seems depressing when you realize that, and I am depressed by all the news about climate change, but at the same time, it's also really powerful, right? Because if the problem is the behavior of this species, and we're that species, then the solution is in the behavior and the thinking of that species. And at this very basic level, if we can start thinking of more ways to make the world a better place by subtracting, by the very definition of what a subtraction is, we're going to be not just slowing the rate at which we approach those planetary boundaries, we're going to be moving away from them, moving in the right direction. And, you know, just something as simple as Ezra's bridge, he built that bridge with two fewer blocks than I did, right? He's got a block that we could put back into the world and give back to nature. And so I think that it has everything to do with climate change, whether it's thinking about divestment, which people are starting to do, to thinking about pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere as a way to address climate change, which more people are starting to do, but could certainly be talked about more in the general public discussion about this, to, you know, everyday things, right? Where it's like, okay, how many people think about recycling? Okay, this is a way that I'm going to address climate change. And it basically is this new behavior that you're adding. And I'm definitely keep recycling or start recycling if you're not. But what about reducing, right? What about reducing the amount of stuff that you consume? There's a reason that reduce, reuse, recycle is ordered the way that it is. Because reduce and reuse are preferable to recycling. Recycling is a last resort, and reduce and reuse are more of subtractive options. And remove, you might even put in front of those. So on these kind of like grand societal level, and what we think about in terms of the Anthropocene, how we're cleaning up CO2 emissions to our own personal environmental behaviors, if we can have a more balanced approach of, you know, adding and subtracting, I think that could be very helpful in our Anthropocene epic.
Well, also, yeah, I think what you're saying is that as it becomes, and as we've seen, in other words, because of the overload of information, we've seen in the work of Cal Newport and the work of Marie Kondo and so on, people are beginning to kind of shift their thinking, subtraction's becoming trendy and so on, that then the negative feeling that we sort of have as a knee-jerk reaction to subtraction, if that gets modified and it becomes on an equal footing with adding, then the chances of that solution to our pollution and climate change problems becomes more appetizing, more readily accepted, and finally, I think it begins to reveal a new pathway that was not as visible before.
Yes, yeah, we'll have achieved success when subtracting is no longer the counterintuitive hot take, right? That means that people are considering it and in kind of equal measure, and when it's viewed as a positive thing. I think that's one of the really hard barriers here, is that, you know, there's a negative connotation around subtraction. And so, you know, we can use different words for it. Certainly we can highlight that it sparks joy like Kondo does.
Yeah.
But I think you're exactly right that a lot of the adding that we do isn't actually bringing us joy, and that subtracting is the way that we give ourselves time to think and time to feel.
And one of the other things that we don't have time to go into, but is, I mean, is we got to change from GDP being the assessment of success of an economy or a society, and because it basically, that GDP is addicted to growth. There's a lot in the book. It's very, I think, easy to read. As I said, it lays out sort of the science of how you can confirm your suspicions about it. It then talks about examples of it at work. It talks about it as in your own life. And the whole thing comes to about 255 pages or something. I would have laughed had this book called Subtract been one of those 500 page tomes. But I highly recommend it because although if you're listening to this show on a regular basis, you go, well, of course we know that, Terrence. That's behind a lot of what you talk about or the guests you have on talk about. It's less obvious than you think. And so the thing of venturing into the book is a way of sort of reminding yourself that this is that there's a challenge here, but that there's a great deal to offer from confronting this challenge.
Yeah, that's a really nice way of putting it. I think that the book can help you kind of sell subtraction to other people. So just the way that you did that beautiful oversight of what Ray Anderson did, right? Yeah. And people will always ask me, oh, how do you sell subtraction? And he shifted the focus, right, from products to services. I agree that that was very fundamental. And then all of a sudden you can sell that service, right? So yep. it answers nuanced questions like that.
Yes, 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 yes. Okay, so again, the book is Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less. You can learn more at LeidyKlotz.com. Leidy, L-E-I-D-Y, Klotz, K-L-O-T-Z, LeidyKlotz, all one word.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement on who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and 10 articles, the relevant, timely, fleshing out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites or at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Leidy Klotz, and keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence, and thank you to your listeners, and you all keep up the good work, too.
Very good.